listening to the Miles to Go podcast, the go-to source for travel tips, news, and reviews you can't afford to miss. Now, here's your host, travel expert Ed Pizza.
Hello, and welcome to this week's episode of the Miles to Go podcast. I've got Summer back with us from Mommy Points blog, and we're going to talk some fun travel stuff. But before we get there, I had just a couple of quick favors to ask of you guys. If you haven't yet subscribed to the podcast, I would absolutely love it if you subscribed and maybe even rated it and told us how we were doing. But the other thing I want to do is I do want to start featuring some questions from readers. So there are two things that that you can do. You can either email me at ed@pizzainmotion.com, which is my blog, or you can find me anywhere on social media at Pizza in Motion, and just let me know a question that you'd like to have answered on a future podcast episode. And if it's not something that I can answer, well, we'll definitely find somebody out there in the blogosphere that's an expert on the topic and get them to answer it, which I think is a great transition to my resident family travel expert and friend, Summer from Mommy Points. How are you doing today, Summer?
I am good, and I'm excited to talk about stuff to get us ready for summer travel.
I know. I'm a little bit jealous of you. You know, we did Harry Potter. We did Universal Studios with the primary purpose being Harry Potter. And we stayed off site and did the whole drive on the property and all that. And it worked out just fine. But from reading your blog this week, I realized that you've got a stay coming up where you guys are going to be staying on site.
Yes. So, I mean, your kids are a little bit older. I mean, I've got the 8-year-old, but I've also got a 2-year-old. So I, won't pay any amount for convenience, but I'll pay some relatively high amounts for convenience still these days, especially when we're talking long, hot July, August, timeframe theme park days in Orlando. So yeah, we are going to be staying on site, most likely at the Lowe's Royal Pacific. But I just completed a stay at the Lowe's Sapphire Falls, which is another on-site Universal hotel, and it was so much nicer than I had envisioned in my head. So I'm really excited to try another one this summer.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned that, because when I looked at the resorts originally, just to set things up for people, the reason why you'd want to stay on-site at Universal is mostly because for the top-tier properties, you get free express passes, which is the Universal Studios equivalent of fast pass at Disney World, a quick access to rides and shorter lines. But it's not all of the hotels. And so your recent stay was at one of the hotels that did not include that benefit, which to me, and again, it was just an assumption. My assumption was, okay, well, if it's not the top tier properties, not only do I not get express passes, but the property itself probably isn't that special. I might not want to stay there.
Right. Yeah. So that's kind of what I thought too. And then I went there and it was a part of a conference. So JetBlue, I was speaking at their conference. They booked the room. But it's apparently a really new hotel, which I had no idea. It was only 2 years old, so it's got the new hotel vibe going for it. And I think based on what I've read online, it's just as nice as the Lowe's Royal Pacific. It actually even has a bigger pool, and it is newer. Hmm. It just doesn't give you that express pass. And I don't know why. I don't know if they just need to keep capacity at a certain threshold. I mean, this is a 1,000-room hotel. So I don't know if that plays into it or what the decision is, but I think the actual hotel, from what I experienced and what I've read from those who've stayed at both, which I'll know better in July after I stay at the other one, but I think the hotel's got to be just as nice. It was so bright and clean and great service. And for a 1,000-room hotel, I mean, you would have never known there was 1,000 other rooms based on the level of service they were giving folks. And compare it to the Disney resorts, which I love, but some of them are several decades old and they do renovations, but still, it's still several decades old. So to be staying on site at a theme park hotel that is so brand new and modern and bright and airy, I was shocked. I mean, I don't know what my expectations were, but they were totally exceeded. So if you don't need express passes, or if you're just traveling, maybe by yourself or with one other person, and the price differential of the express passes, which they're usually at least $100. But the Lowe's Sapphire Falls was amazing if for some reason you don't need the express passes, or you can just buy them out of pocket. But if you do need them, then you'll want to look to some of the properties that include them, which would be the Lowe's Royal Pacific, the Hard Rock, and the Lowe's Portofino Bay. those are the three on-site Universal hotels that'll give you the included express passes for every registered member of your room. This one will at least get you in an hour early to Harry Potter, as well as to some of the Volcano Bay attractions. So there is some perk of staying on site in terms of access, but just not the express passes.
Yeah, and I thought it was interesting. That was one of the things that when I read your post that I didn't really connect. I was pretty focused on express passes for our visit, and I'm going to loop back to that in a second. But I think there's a really important point to emphasize for people that are listening in. You know, if you're a family traveler and you're trying to find advantages to getting in, you know, the advantage here is you do get in an hour early if you're morning folks. We're not necessarily early birds, but if you're morning folks, you know, getting into the parks an hour early is a big benefit. We also noticed too when we got there earlier in the day, just the regular time, that that the lines weren't that bad. But to your point, first off, I did not know that Sapphire Falls had 1,000 rooms. Wow.
Yeah,
that will tell you exactly why it's not part of the Express Pass program, because while we were down there during spring break, which is certainly a busy time, as you know, having been to Disney World, you know, Christmas, New Year's, some of those times are really, really busy and the Fast Pass lines can be long. But I'd say 90 to 95% of the year, a Fast Pass line at Disney World is 15 minutes or less. And the difference that we found at Universal Studios was if the line was an hour or an hour and a half at Universal Studios for the regular line, the Express Pass line was probably 45 minutes. So it saved you time, but you were still standing in line for a serious chunk of time. And I have to imagine that if they added another 1,000 hotel rooms worth of people that were eligible for that, that number would get even more unwieldy than I think it already is.
Yeah, I think that's got to be it. It is a massive hotel. They do a lot of conventions there, too, which is why I was there. So it's huge, huge, huge. It would add, obviously, thousands more people to those lines.
Yeah, and I, you know, again, just my personal opinion, I think for folks that are paying, and I agree, most days it's $100 or more. And I think that's a lot to pay to wait in line 45 minutes. And, you know, the folks at Universal are also using demand-based pricing, which I get. Which means you're going to pay even more for the Fast Pass when the lines are longer, and you're going to stand in line longer for a Fast Pass and pay more for it during the peak times, even though you're quote unquote saving time. It's definitely a different feel than Disney, where you know you don't get unlimited access to those Fast Pass lines, but you get 3, 4, 5 shots a day where the lines are going to be short. And we just had to rewire our brains for that with Universal Studios and how we planned our day out, because our kids just aren't used to waiting in line 45 minutes to an hour. We'll go find something fun to do and then ride a ride when we can get on it in 10 or 15 minutes.
Exactly. Yeah, that's our Disney strategy too. My kids are not used to lines. So this will be interesting. It'll be our first Universal Studios Orlando trip. So it's been a learning curve thus far. And a big part of the learning curve has been the price tag.
Yeah.
I mean, you've got to pay extra for everything. You know, at Disney, you get the fast passes included. But at Universal, as we've talked about, you've either got to buy them at 100 or more per person, or you've got to buy up to the highest tier of on-site hotels. And then, as you say, you're still waiting in somewhat of a line. So I'm just going to ignore that part for now so I don't dread it. But I'll file it away for future reference.
Well, you're also going at one of the hotter times of year. And while that works against you in terms of having to keep the kids hydrated and, you know, not cranky, it works for you in that the park shouldn't be, you know, wildly packed like they might be on Christmas and spring break. And you might be able to work an early and late strategy. We found when we were there for spring break, I was surprised that on, I won't remember whether it was Friday or Saturday night, but Friday or Saturday night in the peak of spring break time, the Harry Potter World lines were not bad at the very end of the evening. It was a lot less crowded than I was expecting on one of the two. The other night was unbelievably crazy, but one of them wasn't horrible. So I don't have all the strategy down, but that's sort of the advice I can share for now. And, you know, to your other point about, you know, whether to buy up or not, our specific experience was if I bought 4, 2-adult, 2-kid, 3-day tickets with express passes for our family for spring break, it was actually $100 cheaper for me to buy annual passes for the 4 of us. Mm-hmm. The difference there is you only get Express Pass access after 4 p.m. And, you know, in some cases, those lines are going to be longer, and so we sort of have to deal with that. But we also get the full year of the park instead of 3 days.
Yeah, and that's – I know you guys have do the annual pass strategy with Disney at times, and it really does make sense if you can time your visits to where you're having, you know, at least more than one in that 12 months. Even if you're just doing two family visits, assuming they're, you know, longer than a day or two, those passes usually play out at, you know, Universal and Disney and almost any major theme park. So it's definitely a strategy to consider if you can get back there more than once in 12 months.
Yeah, and one of the things that folks might not know, which I didn't know and learned afterwards, is your 12 months doesn't start till the first day you walk in the park. So if you're a planner like Summer, who already has vacations planned for 2021, you can –
True.
See, I was joking, but there was a reasonable chance I was
right.
It's true. you can plan this first trip and just know you've got 12 months from the date of this trip. And so there's a reasonable chance you could hit it. The other interesting thing about Universal Studios that's different than Disney is, and I need to write this blog post because I think it's a good value. When you renew your annual passes with Universal Studios, you don't actually renew for a full year. If you choose the payment plan, they actually charge you in month 13, you pay 1/12 of what the annual pass is. You essentially roll to a monthly membership. So it is possible to squeeze that next trip in, even if it's not quite at 12 months, in that 13th month for, you know, 10% of what it would have cost you to book the whole trip.
Yeah, you need to write that post. I say this and then we keep going to Orlando. I'm not going again in 12 months. I say that now. But for someone that is, yeah, that's super helpful information.
So let's just be clear, folks. It is early May 2018, and we will just mark this date where Summer says that she will not be going to Orlando again for the 12 months after her July trip. So you've heard it here. It's recorded. It's captured for posterity.
It's probably not true, but we're gonna still stick with it.
Well, especially not true if you happen to score another Daily Getaways deal, because didn't you score one of the Daily Getaways Universal packages?
Yeah, so what I got was actually a Lowe's hotel package. Mm-hmm. It's a sleeper hit of the Daily Getaways, which most of the good ones are. So it's advertised as two nights at a luxury Lowe's hotel, and they give you a list of a dozen or so properties where you can use it. And it's two nights, so it was $325. But one of the hotels that's eligible is the Lowe's Royal Pacific, which is the one that does give you express passes. So the weekend we were looking at going this summer is about $450 all in per night to stay there. So it'd be $900 for two nights, which is insane.
Yeah.
But with this thing, you can stay two nights for $325 by buying this Daily Getaway certificate. So it still hasn't come. So I'm still not 100% booked. But, you know, assuming it works out, and even if it doesn't work our dates, it would work some dates, most dates, you can stay there two nights for $325 all in and get those express passes, which is almost any day of the year going to beat the going rates for the hotel. So I'm rolling the dice a little bit because we do have somewhat fixed dates. But if you can get it with some date flexibility, you know, next year, it's already sold out for this year. But if they do it again next year, and you have some date flexibility, then it's definitely going to be the cheapest way to stay two nights at Royal Pacific and get those express passes.
Yeah, I think it's a phenomenal deal, especially having felt the acute pain of buying Universal Studios tickets. I was bummed to be on a plane when they went on sale and missed them this year. And I really do applaud you trying to grab one for me. I wish we could.
We had one in the cart for you. We just couldn't get hold of you in time. And I'm just not familiar enough with the blackout dates to trust that we want two of these on hand. But hopefully we'll know a lot more soon when ours should arrive any day now.
And I am acutely familiar with United Airlines' inconsistent Wi-Fi, which kept me from being able to get your messages at that exact moment.
Oh, me too. You remind me. I need to submit some of those. I need a refund notes to them.
Well, before we run out of time, I wanted to touch base on something else, too, since, you know, you and I talk family stuff so much. You had mentioned in a blog post recently about American Express lowering the minimum age requirement for authorized users on credit cards.
Yeah, so Most of the banks will allow you to add your kids as authorized users to the cards, but the age at which you can do it varies. And most banks actually don't publish a minimum age. In some cases, that means there isn't one. As it stands with Chase, I think you could add your newborn. They don't seem to care on the age. I've added my six-year-old to a Chase card before. But American Express has always been 15, or at least as long as I've been paying attention, 15 has been the minimum to add an authorized user. And recently, I just got one of their random marketing emails reminding you can add your kids starting at age 13. And so I did a little digging, and it seems a few months ago they switched. So you no longer have to be 15 to be an authorized user on an Amex account. You only have to be 13. And you can add them online. I don't think that applies to business cards. I'm getting a lot of reports from people who are trying that it's just personal cards. So stick to the personal cards probably. But yeah, once you hit 13, you can get that Amex card authorized user in your name. And it's a really good idea. I think it's just safer than carrying around cash. And you can track where your kid's spending them. There's more protections. But you're also starting to build that credit history so that when your kid is 18, assuming they're ready to manage their own credit card accounts, they will have some account history to help them get approved for those cards going forward. It doesn't mean they'll have super awesome credit day one when they hit 18, but it does help a little bit. The people I know who've been doing this for their teenagers, it's paid off.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I do like the idea of, like I said, you send your kids off to, you know, to hang out with friends, or they're, you know, going with another family to the movies or something, and you're tucking cash in their pocket. It's fine, it works, but there, you know, certainly are risks there.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, and our oldest is only 8, so we're not really to the point yet that we're turning her loose, like really loose. We won't be for a while. But yeah, if you're going to be spending the weekend with grandma or spend the night with friends or whatever, I do think it's just more versatile than cash. I mean, there's nothing wrong with sticking a 20 in their wallet too, but if they're going to be on a longer trip or something, especially as they hit those early teenage years, I think a card is just so much more versatile, and going ahead and having it in their name is great. Now, don't forget, you can set limits. You don't have to have an authorized user card with unlimited spending. You can cap it. I think with Amex, the minimum you can cap it at is $200 a month, but still, that's going to prevent any like humongous damage. So don't forget that stuff.
Yeah, and the other thing, too, that I like about Amex versus Chase is Amex will issue you unique card numbers for different family members, whereas with Chase personal cards, they don't do that. So this gives you the ability to segregate the charges for those kids and make it a little bit easier when the statement comes in to know who spent what.
Not only that, but you've got one more now when they do Amex offers. I mean, you never know which ones are going to pop up for your account, but since they're the unique card numbers, you can now have one more card to use if there's an Amex offer available that you really like.
That's a very good point. Well, cool. Well, next up, we've got an interesting segment with a friend of mine, Mike, who's been on the podcast before, but he's going to explain a term to me and to everybody listening that I hear all the time, but I can't say I knew the depth of it. So hang on for that. And before we kick Summer out the door, Summer, why don't you let people know where they can find you when you're not talking about really expensive Universal trips with me on the podcast.
Yeah, so if you want to read about really expensive Universal trips, I write daily on the blog mommypoints.com, M-O-M-M-Y points, and then I hang out on Twitter at @mommy_points.
Awesome, great. Well, hopefully we'll have you back after your trip to let folks know how it went, and I hope you guys have an awesome time and that you don't get any triple-digit weather days while you're down there.
Absolutely. Thank you, Ed.
Thanks for being on, Summer. We'll be right back on the Miles to Go podcast. If you're listening to this podcast, you know the places Miles and Points can take you. Maybe you've been saving up those Miles and Points to plan that special once-in-a-lifetime trip, but you can't find what you're looking for. The experts at BookYourReward.com have redeemed over 3 billion miles. That's billion, with a B. You won't find anyone with more experience to book your dream vacation. BookYourReward.com will provide you with concierge booking services to get you where you want to go, how you want to get there, and using the rewards program of your choice. All for a lot less than the cost of a domestic coach airline ticket. For listeners of the Miles to Go podcast, we got a special limited time offer for the month of May. Receive a $25 Amazon gift card with your first paid booking at BookYourReward.com. Drop us a line at miles2gopodcast@gmail.com with your itinerary for more details.
Today I'm chatting with Mike LaRosa from the Co-Workaholic podcast. And the interesting thing is, when I first met Mike, which goes back, what, 2 years now?
Almost, yeah, just over 2 years.
I'll be honest, I didn't actually know what a co-working facility was by name. I ended up knowing what they were. I certainly didn't know what a co-workaholic was. And when Mike decided that he was going to be in Virginia the 1 week in 2018 that I was actually going to be home, it seemed like a great time to sit down and record a podcast segment. And I figured, what better way to do that than to ask him the question that I asked in the very beginning, for those who aren't millennials, older guys like me, what exactly is co-working?
That's a great question. Thanks for having me. So for those of you out there that are unfamiliar with the term co-working, it's basically a shared workspace. So it's not a new concept. It's been out there for quite some time. Anyone familiar with Regus or executive office centers know that for years you've been able to rent kind of boardroom style offices by the hour, by the week, by the month. And co-working's just kind of exploded as more people work remotely.
Yeah, the interesting thing I think I see when you talk about Regus, and I do know the Regus facilities, but especially because American Airlines used to have this partnership where you had you had sort of like junior memberships to the Regus facilities. But I think the interesting thing when I see a lot of the co-working spaces is that a lot of them have very wide open bullpens where they're essentially just rows of desks where people are somehow quietly and in a very disciplined fashion working.
Yeah, it's kind of like the polar opposite. So if Regus is more of your traditional kind of law firm style stuffy boardroom, co-working spaces, a lot of them have private offices, but a lot of the time it's this open kind of cafe type feel, right? People are comfortable sitting on a couch or at a communal table as long as they've got their headphones on.
And so, you know, this is obviously a much more professional or equipped version of sitting in your local Starbucks when you're traveling and getting some work done. If you're not you, a co-workaholic mm-hmm. who knows where a lot of these facilities are, how does a normal run-of-the-mill guy like me find a co-working facility in a random city across the world?
Yeah, so, I mean, like with anything else in this world, Google is really your number one go-to tool. Just search co-working, and if you have the geo setting enabled, it will just know where you are and give you the closest co-working spaces. If you're looking for a little bit more of a detailed tool, kind of like a TripAdvisor, I would recommend coworker.com. That's my go-to search site for co-working spaces.
And as I keep an eye on your various social media feeds, and I'll use Instagram specifically from a picture standpoint, you've ended up at some pretty cool locations. And one of the ones that I saw that really just looked like, wow, I want to go sit and work there, even though I'm not a co-working guy per se, was in the Middle East. I think you were in Dubai?
Yeah, last year in Dubai. You know, what's so exciting about co-working is that it's happening everywhere. In all different ways, right? So whether you're in Bali, whether you're in the financial district of Singapore, in New York City, or in Dubai, co-working is taking place, and it's in all different shapes and sizes and forms. And so I had the pleasure of working on a project. Wyndham has a really cool millennial traveler brand called Trip. And so Trip by Wyndham, the brand new Dubai location, has a co-working space in it. And they were really smart. We worked with them to develop the benefits and the amenities of the hotel and incorporate that as a part of a membership. So we can say that it's the only co-working space in Dubai that's got access to a spa, a gym, and a pool. That's the truth.
That's pretty cool. Yeah, and so you've got folks who are may own a building somewhere, and they're trying to figure out what's the right fit. And so in this case, the folks that own the Wyndham, the Trip by Wyndham in Dubai, decided that they want to dedicate some of the space that they had allocated for the hotel specifically for co-working. And do you think that most of the folks that are using that co-working facility are also staying in the hotel, or is it a mix of people that are traveling to the area as well, or locals?
It's a mix, considering that the space has only been open open really officially since November, we see about 70% of users are locals, which is really cool for a hotel property to encourage local residents that wouldn't normally go to a hotel on a day-to-day basis. They're bringing more people into the property, and that's what the developer wanted: more people to eat at the restaurants and more people to use the space.
Yeah, that is pretty cool for an owner. You know, you and I were talking earlier. We were trying to figure out cool locations for co-working facilities, and we sort of started noodling around. You had mentioned that there's a one that just opened up in one of the airport hotels in Amsterdam, so you know, an easy shuttle ride from the airport. I'm curious what other, I don't know if cool is the right word, but what other interesting places are you seeing co-working facilities pop up in right now?
Yeah, so I mean, I think number one, anywhere in kind of Southeast Asia, kind of low cost of living, or anywhere where there's a lot of digital nomads. These are people that tend to be internet dependent workers that can work from anywhere. So we're seeing massive growth of co-working in Bali, Chiang Mai, Thailand, Siem Reap, Cambodia. I don't like doing cool lists or like, you know, biggest list, but I would say most unique spaces out there. One of them is Relay Spaces. It's a cool concept in Atlanta. It's in a warehouse, and it's actually for drop shipping businesses. So small businesses that do a lot of shipping, whether it be on Etsy or eBay or Amazon, part of their membership includes shared drop shipping and warehouse services. You've got Eastern Foundry, which is an awesome space here in DC, which is dedicated to supporting small business owners that are veterans in working with the government. There's also a really cool space in San Francisco called Bespoke. It's at the Westfield, the flagship Westfield, right at the shopping center mall downtown. And then one of my other favorite ones, it's kind of a shameless plug, is you can co-work at Second City, which is the world-famous comedy club in Chicago. And that's a project I was involved on, and you can access that space through DeskPass, which is a pretty cool kind of like ClassPass for co-working app.
Yeah, I kind of figured that there had to be some services where you could purchase day passes. You said it's called DeskPass?
Yeah, DeskPass is kind of the forefront in the industry. They've got locations in Austin, Denver, LA, San Francisco, Chicago, New York, and a couple more cities coming. It allows you to pay one fee and bounce between a bunch of different spaces.
Yeah, that is cool. So any bucket list co-working facilities that are on your list of places you need to get to? You're on the road more than I am.
I'm trying. Well, I don't know. We'll see at the end of the year how that works out. Well, I'm super stoked. There's a brand new space that's opening up in New Zealand that I'm going to later this month that's integrated childcare with co-working. And I'm still dying to go to a pretty big space in China. There's a couple kind of cool brands that have popped up that are kind of major WeWork competitors. And it would be really interesting to kind of see what that space looks like. I've seen photos. It's like the largest space in China, so you can only imagine how big it is.
Yeah, that's awesome. All right, well, before we run out of time, why don't you tell people where they can find you?
Yeah, you can find me at coworkaholic.com. I'm on Instagram at coworkaholic, on Twitter at thecoworkaholic, and of course you can find us on Facebook.
Awesome. Hey, Mike, thanks for stopping by the podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
We'll be right back on the Miles to Go podcast.
If you're listening to this podcast, you know the places Miles and Points can take you. Maybe you've been saving up those miles and points to plan that special once-in-a-lifetime trip, but you can't find what you're looking for. The experts at BookYourReward.com have redeemed over 3 billion miles. That's billion, with a B. You won't find anyone with more experience to book your dream vacation. BookYourReward.com will provide you with concierge booking services to get you where you want to go, how you want to get there, and using the rewards program of your choice. All for a lot less than the cost of a domestic coach airline ticket. For listeners of the Miles to Go podcast, we've got a special limited-time offer for the month of May. Receive a $25 Amazon gift card with your first paid booking at BookYourReward.com. Drop us a line at milestogopodcast@gmail.com with your itinerary for more details. As we wrap up this week's episode, we've got just the final two pennies left. And this week I decided that we would try to get a little bit closer to the namesake, and I actually have two different things, two pennies to finish us off. The first is, you know, as we're entering the month of May here, I realized I actually haven't left the country yet. And for most people listening, that's probably not an abnormal thing for you. I happen to do a lot of international traveling, and I've been known to have the occasional crazy, you know, 2-day trip to Australia, if you will. But I was at a meeting the other day, and somebody who I know, you know, decently well, said, you know, wow, you just have the awesomest travel. And I thought about that as I'd been to just a laundry list of small rural cities across the U.S., which were all, you know, nice in their own respects, but not what you'd call aspirational travel, like Venice or Milan or Paris, if you will. But as we head into the summer, I'm getting ready to gear up for some family travel. Again, it'll be more focused on the U.S. But I think it's good to point out that two things here. Not all my travel is glamorous. I'm a business traveler. I'm, you know, slogging it out most nights in limited service hotels, far away from my family, not really enjoying myself. So I do understand the rigors of business travel and how to make the most of it, if you will. And, you know, if you have questions about how to make it better, I hope you'll share those with me so I can help answer them for you. The second part, the second penny, if you will, goes back to a blog post I wrote a few days ago about Southwest Airlines. And I wanted to loop back on this because it's still on my mind. Southwest had the very tragic incident where a passenger died when they had an engine failure on a flight. And then they had another incident shortly thereafter where there was a window that cracked and the flight landed out of an abundance of caution and nobody was hurt. But after that second incident, there were a number of news sources that trumpeted the controversies at Southwest and the emergency landings and the pattern of maintenance problems. And I want to keep this podcast clean, so I'll use friendlier words than I might normally, but that's all just bunk. These events, you know, the loss of life on a Southwest flight was horrible and tragic. It saddens me to hear things like that, and it reminds us that there's still risk in air travel. But Southwest is a safe airline to fly. If I had to go somewhere tomorrow where they were flying, I'd have no problem getting on one of their planes. There are plenty of oversight authorities that could shut them down if they weren't a safe airline. And I bemoan the news media for painting this out to be a controversy or a scandal or a larger systemic issue. It's a horrible situation that happened. It's a very fairly rare situation that you'd have an engine failure like that, but it is a rare situation and again, a tragic ending. The broken window is somewhat rare, but not unheard of. Planes land frequently when oxygen masks are deployed for safety reasons. In this case, the oxygen mask didn't even deploy. So I just think we're creating undue fear where it doesn't need to be. There are plenty of people that have a general fear of flying, and I get it. It's a very real thing. I don't think we need the news media to help fan those flames, if you will. Let's try to be a little bit more responsible in framing up what we're faced with. There are thousands of flights every day that take off and land safely, and the tragedy is a tragedy. There's absolutely no question about it. But that alone doesn't make Southwest an unsafe airline to fly. That's a full wrap on this week's episode. I hope you enjoyed coming along the ride with us. We'll be back next week with more travel tips and news to share with you. If you're enjoying the podcast, I hope you'll do me a favor and rate it real quick. Make sure you subscribe to it. Those are things that help us boost it up in the ratings. And if you have a question, I hope you'll shoot us an email. My email is ed@pizzainmotion.com. Share us a question that we can read on the air. If we use your question on the air, we'll send you an Amazon gift card to say thanks for sharing it with us. We'd love to answer some of those questions to get answers to your most burning questions about miles and points. As we wrap up today, I'd also like to say thanks to our sponsors. Guests of the show will receive a free Gogo Wi-Fi in-flight internet pass. Gogo's been a sponsor of the podcast from day one, and I'm certainly thankful to have them around from the beginning. And our newest sponsor, BookYourAward.com, the leader in helping folks book their awards, making sure they can redeem their points and miles for that dream trip. That's a full wrap. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time. Until then, we've got miles to go.